Hi, this is Senator Bernie Sanders. Last year, along with John Nichols, the great progressive journalist with The Nation magazine, I wrote a best-selling book called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. In it, we tackle the issues that you don't hear much about in the mainstream media, from the extraordinary wealth and income inequality that our nation is experiencing, to the growing labor movement, to corporate control over the media itself. If I must say so myself, this is a very good book, and it's just been republished in paperback. If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.
In this segment, we're going to talk about the media, which is a favorite topic of yours, although not necessarily something that you're favorable toward. You and I got to know each other quite well. It's actually
about 100 years ago.
Yeah, it was just after Lincoln's re-elect, I think. But we got to know each other pretty well because Robert McChesney and I had written a series of books on media and on the challenges there. And you actually wrote the introduction to one of them and was certainly a part of the circle. And you brought us up to Vermont to do some town meetings in Montpelier and Burlington. And we were testing something. It was the question of, could media be an issue? Were there enough people who actually thought media was failing them that they would come out in big numbers? And it turned out we had packed audiences there, and this was years ago. And for me, at least, that was a great lesson that this was a fundamental issue that we ought to be talking about a lot more.
Well, the bottom line is, obviously, you can't talk about politics or economics or about anything else without talking about media. And let's go through the basic facts of what's going on. And I know that you and Bob have written extensively on this. When people buy cable TV, and they get, 100, 200 channels, or they go to some nice newsstand where there are all kinds of publications and newspapers, they talk about, or they may think that there's a diversity of ownership. Hundreds of TV stations getting all kinds of points of view. At the end of the day, there are a very small number of multinational conglomerates who own all of those media outlets. And in fact, I think we're down to 7 or 8 major media conglomerates in the United States that control about what I think 90% of the entertainment and news that people receive. Is that about right?
That's about right.
All right. So you got a handful of very large corporations that determine what we see, hear, and read.
And they're literally trying to buy each other out, so there's even fewer.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. So the question is, we got our friend Donald Trump who goes around telling everybody it's fake news. Any article that's critical of him is fake news. My experience, and I deal with media every single day and I have for, dozens of years, is very, very rarely do I find somebody writing something which misquotes me or intentionally tries to make me look bad. That's not the issue. The issue is, what does media choose to emphasize, and what does media choose not to emphasize? That's the issue. And what I will tell you, as I mentioned just the other day to you, is that in all my years in politics, nobody, not one media person in the hundreds, if not thousands of media interviews that I have done, nobody said to me, Bernie, what are you going to do about this outrageous level of income and wealth inequality? Well, I happen to think that the movement toward oligarchy and income and wealth inequality is an enormously important issue. Not one media person asked me that. We are the richest country in the history of the world. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country. You would think, some reporter would say, well, Bernie, what are you going to do about child poverty? Why is it so high? Why do 25% of American seniors live on $15,000 a year or less? What are you going to do about that, Bernie? And another example, which is, as I say this as chairman of the Health Education Labor Committee, is we have a dysfunctional healthcare system which spends twice as much per capita as any other system on earth, and yet our outcomes are worse. You might think somebody would say, Bernie, what are you going to do about a system that spends $13,000 yet a life expectancy is lower than other countries? 85 million people have no health care. What are you going to do about that? That's a major issue, Bernie. No, never happens. Those issues are never, ever raised. So every day I walk out, you know, the news of the day, somebody decides what the news of the day and your tenure report is asking you. But that has a lot to do with who owns the media and what these guys would like to see emphasized or not emphasized.
So let's dig into that a little bit. You and I have talked about this a lot over the years. And one of the things that I think gets your back up a bit is when you go on a show and there are fundamental things you want to talk about, and instead the host really wants you to gossip, right? You want to talk about this personality or this thing.
So what do I do, John, when they ask me those questions?
Well,
I often ignore them and tell them what I want to say anyhow, right?
Well, but that's what I wanted to ask about, because it is an interesting dynamic. Maybe it's the value of running for president, because it gave you a little bit of the ability to say to these folks, yeah, you know what? That's not as important as this.
But you don't even say that. You just do it. I mean, look. You're right. A lot of it is gossip. What do you think of what the president said? Who cares what I think of what the president said? You know? So I will try to pivot into other issues. I do that all of the time. So you walk into a program and say, there are three things I want to say here. I don't give a damn what the questions are. And when they say you're not answering the question. And you know what I say? You're not asking the right question. I'm giving you the right answer. You're not giving me the right question. But, you know, that's part of what you got to do. But bottom line is, when we talk about the serious problems that we have in our faltering democracy, where people are giving up on the political process, where they feel the government or media doesn't understand what they're going through, a lot of that has to do with the inability or the refusal of corporate media to cover the reality of people's lives.
But this is where a problem comes up, because you do that. You redirect. And there's some other folks who do as well. But an awful lot of our elected officials don't. They will, you know, they go right into the gossip of the day.
Right.
And in effect, that defines the narrative into this very narrow zone, which doesn't have a lot to do with people's lives.
No, it's nothing to do with people's lives. And, you know, it's common. I understand why people do it. So you ask me a question, you want to be not rude, right? You ask me a question, you want to answer it. I fall into that occasionally. But on the other hand, you have to say, what is, you know, in a sense, one uses the media to try to get a message out regardless of what the questions are. But, you know, the more important issue is that there are a lot of people who are hurting in this country right now. They want answers as to why they are hurting. They want discussion as to how we can improve our nation, how we can provide health care to all, how we can raise wages, how we can deal with climate, how we can end bigotry. And unfortunately, we don't have anywhere near the kind of discussion on those issues that we should.
And what a lot of our media, where they especially fail, is that when you kind of go into the roots of things, the systemic realities. And so our book is titled, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. You never get asked about capitalism.
No.
Nobody ever says to you, unless I'm missing something, you know, looks like this system may not be working so well.
No, that's not on the table. That question is never asked. And I'll give you what I'll tell you what else is never asked. That's interesting. You know, I began to think about it, you know, as we wrote the book. If somebody gets shot today, Washington, D.C. or any place else, people are outraged, you know, and they're upset about it and want to punish the criminal. We have, and I do, we don't want to see people getting shot or raped or anything else. We get outraged. We're allowed to get outraged. But there are certain issues that we are not allowed to get outraged in. I'll give you one very contemporary issue as of today. Right now, because of the refusal of Israel to allow trucks to get through the border, there are hundreds of thousands of children who are facing starvation. Now, to my mind, this is outrageous. I mean, it is really unspeakable, and it's very, very upsetting to me. And to, I think, millions of Americans. Do you think there's any outrage? Do you hear much outrage? It'll be discussed to some degree in this way or that way. But the fact that the United States is putting money into the Israeli military has done it for years, wants to put another $10 billion in unfettered military aid to Netanyahu's right-wing government. Wouldn't you think that there'd be a level of outreach? I'm not saying this issue is not discussed, but the very simple issue is, why would we give $10 billion to a government that is deliberately starving children? Simple question. How often do you have that question?
You don't. And it's interesting because so much of our media is an outrage machine.
Right, exactly. But you only, the outrage is quite selective.
Yeah.
Another example, as you well know, in the last few years, we have learned that the fossil fuel industry knew some 60 years ago that carbon emissions were going to cause climate change and cause massive damage to the earth, right? They knew it 60 years ago. Now, how much media discussion has there been about the culpability of these fossil fuel executives who lied to the American people, who made huge profits over the years, and are responsible for the massive amounts of destruction that we're seeing today? Now, you would think, with all of the floods and the extreme weather disturbances and the drought and the heat waves, somebody would hold somebody responsible. Have you ever heard in one corporate media show the idea that these executives would be held responsible? I have not.
And in the book, we talk about that as something that you really should be liable for.
Right.
Right? I mean, you've damaged some.
A kid robs a store, that's a criminal offense. A handful of corporate executives lie about what their product does, cause trillions of dollars in debt. I don't know how you calculate what climate change is going to do to the planet. There's no discussion of holding them accountable. None.
How much do you think that this is rooted in the ownership of
the
media and also in where their revenues come from?
Sure. I mean, in both cases, that's right. I mean, I'll give you another example. Again, as chairman of the Help Committee, I deal with this issue. There are prescription drugs which now cost, been around for a long time, which cost pennies to manufacture. And there are children in Africa, Asia, Latin America who are dying of diseases that this medicine can cure. And the drug companies are refusing to allow generics to be made. They're manipulating the patent system in order to maintain high prices. So what they are saying to desperately poor people, I'm sorry, you're going to die if you cannot afford the price of the prescription drug that I want. Sorry about that. You're going to die. Now, put that in. You help me out here. Put that into a moral context. Somebody shoots somebody out on the street. We say, this is a crime. This is a terrible act. What do we say to a drug company that for a few cents can probably save millions of lives of children who will die of easily cured diseases? How do we frame that?
Yeah. And think about this. These are actually, I mean, I don't begin to say that there's, you know, one perfect way to do journalism, but it does strike me that these are dramatic stories. These are great stories, not happy stories, but ones that are powerful, that if you put resources into telling them about the wrongdoing of a drug company, about the lies that people are told.
About the criminal activity.
Yeah, that would be a good story, right?
If I am lying, if I'm producing a product
that
is incredibly destructive, and I say, hey, John, this product is fine. We have hired these people and scientists, we pay them. They tell me there's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. What is that? And think about all the destruction we have already seen from climate change and what we will see in the coming years. It is a major, major criminal offense. Not only do we not hold these guys accountable, media doesn't even talk about it.
And there was, when you were coming up politically, it wasn't perfect by any means, and I don't think we should be romantic about what media was. But there was sort of a golden age of investigative reporting. After Watergate and some of that, after Ralph Nader and the great work that he did, you had a lot of media that sort of thought, well, we're going to make our name by going out and exposing things. That, while there are great groups like ProPublica and others that do stuff now, there's not that sort of competition to go and find the great story that upends a corporation And I think it's part of the, in many ways, the collapse of a lot of our local media and a lot of our, you know, regional media around the country, right? We've still got the New York Times, Washington Post, but we've lost a lot of those papers and a lot of those news outlets around the country that, as a source of pride, went and did a great investigative story, got a Pulitzer Prize for it.
Maybe right, I mean, that's true. But whether or not they got a Pulitzer Prize, what they did do is cover the mayor's office and the school board.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, I can tell you, I can see the change in Vermont, which has not been as hard hit as many other communities around the country. Mm-hmm. But when I was mayor of the city of Burlington, you know, we'd do a press conference, had a whole bunch of media there. It is much fewer right now. And what that means, there, we call them media deserts, is yeah. what the word is.
Yeah.
But, and you know this stuff better than I am, I do, but there are hundreds of communities where there is now no local media at all.
Yeah.
And how do you hold the mayor or the city council responsible, accountable?
In fact, there's a pretty good argument that the country itself is becoming a media desert. That, you know, that we almost make a mistake when we talk about media deserts as individual places, because there's so much of the country where the, what was the daily newspaper is either gone, and we've lost literally hundreds and hundreds of papers across the country, or what remains is so diminished that the staff has been cut to one-tenth or even less of what it was, that it's just sort of going through the motions. It's not beginning to go out and tell the full story.
Well, there's, and we cover this in
the book a lot, yeah.
But I want to go to another issue that we talk about in the book. In America, 60% of our people live paycheck to paycheck. In America, you got three people who own more wealth than the bottom half of American society, and you got billionaires who are making out like bandits and making huge amounts of money. In much of the mainstream media, the word working class is never used. So you have a nation in which a majority of the people are working class, but that phrase is never used. Right? You have clearly a ruling class. I mean, people who not only own a significant part of the economy, not only own the media, not only have super PACs and make huge campaign contributions. That's called a ruling class. You don't have to be disparaging. You say, all right, you know, you're wearing a black suit. All right, a black jacket. That's not disparaging. They didn't say ruling class.
I don't know. The book behind you thought it was disparaging. Yeah.
All right, but we don't. So we don't. We're not allowed to talk about class.
Yeah.
That's largely outside of the framework of discussion. That's a huge issue.
Well, and when you take that out of the discussion, when our media takes that out of the discussion, then we have a huge number of people who look at the affairs of the day and say, well, I'm sort of a spectator here at best, right? This isn't about me. This is about, you know, what some politician is doing. They may get very frustrated with it. They may well turn off to it and say, why should I care about this? And it feeds the frustration.
And it negates the reality.
Yeah.
There is a ruling class. And if you want to understand what is happening in America, you have to understand that reality. There are a small number of people with enormous amounts of power. Most people say, yeah, of course that's true. That's true. Who denies that? But it's not discussed. And we don't even use the phraseology. And until very recently, there was almost no discussion of the trade union movement. I wonder how many people, here you have an AFL-CIO that has, 14 million members, something like that? How many people out there know the name of the leadership of the AFL-CIO or the other major unions in this country? Never discussed. Very rarely on television.
We have a business section of the paper, and we have business networks. We don't have a labor section or labor networks, even though, in reality, there are a lot more people who are, you know, in a labor union than our CEOs.
Right. And I would think that the average American wants to know what's going on with fellow workers.
Mm-hmm. And this gets to an interesting thing, because when we don't cover the labor movement, as an example, now it's getting covered more now, but when we didn't cover the labor movement, there's just an awful lot of people that don't even know that's an option. Right?
It's not. Exactly, of course.
Yeah. And during the Great Depression, we were talking about Bob McChesney a little bit. He and I did a lot of research for one of our books. And during the Great Depression, there was something like roughly 1,000 labor reporters in America.
Was there right?
Yeah, virtually every paper of consequence had a labor reporter. I used to pull out editions of like the Toledo Blade look at the front page from the mid-30s, of the, they had big pictures, they had a lot more stories there, right? Of the maybe 12 stories on the front page, six of them would be labor stories, a strike, an organizing drive, something like that. And now, I mean, it's better now. A lot of young people are going into it, but for a while there, you could count the labor reporters in America on your hand, on two hands.
And how often do you see on the mainstream TV networks working class people?
Yeah.
Not very often. Yeah. And certainly when you see them as often as not, it's in a negative way.
And let me ask you about the other side of this, right? Because we're talking about, you know, we're going digging in a little bit to media here and talking about what works and what doesn't work in media. It would seem to me that one of the most amazing stories, and one that, you could cover it in a whole bunch of different ways, in the midst of COVID, right, when people are literally sacrificing, saying, you know, you've got to stay home, you've got to, you know, try and get by, you've got Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk competing for who gets to shoot each other into space, or who gets to be the first person to have a rocket, right, which is, in this case, a toy. And it got covered as sort of exciting, right, rather than as, this is kind of absurd.
Right. Well, the issue of the lifestyles of the rich and the famous, rather than the struggles of ordinary working people, I don't have to tell you which the media, the corporate media, prefers to cover.
So let's talk about a little bit about one of the ways in which the narrative in America is framed. We have very strong networks of right-wing media in this country. And so we have issues that are sort of built up on the right that then move into mainstream discussion. And so you end up in the Senate talking about issues that at least initially were generated a lot on, you know, right-wing talk radio or right-wing media. How much is this a factor in our politics?
Oh, well, Fox and Rupert Murdoch. I would say, you know, Rupert Murdoch turns out to be one of the more destructive people on the planet, and has, you know, foisted, you know, anti-climate change ideas over and over again. And has developed a very successful formula of appealing to people based on some of the more baser instincts of human nature. So right-wing media obviously plays an enormous role. It is certainly one of the reasons why we've seen the Republican Party go from a center-right party to a right-wing extremist party.
And you have impeachments of people now, and you know, there's a way that politics is sort of now so reflective of stuff that's going on in media, but not reflective of what ordinary people are demanding.
Right. And I mean, that's right. And if you look at the polling on issue after issue, what do the American people want? It's very different than what you're seeing in right-wing media. You know, people understand that the middle class is struggling. They want to make sure that they want to see that their kids are able to afford to go to college. They want decent child care for their little ones. They understand that health care, in many cases, is a human right. They want to raise the minimum wage. You know, we have, there are conservative states recently. In fact, yeah. I don't believe that a referendum on a state, at a state level, has lost.
No, it's winning all over. Yeah, and when a state will vote for Trump, at the same time vote to raise his minimum wage. Yeah. So this has been, you know, we've talked about a lot of the negatives here. One of the things that we do in the book is actually talk about ways that we might be able to get ourselves out of some of this mess. Not all of it, but at least some of it.
Well, there are a couple of issues here, and you're right. We got to talk about the new realities of what technology, and we're taking advantage of it as we speak. But I'll give you a very concrete example of where I think modern technology and social media has played a very positive role. When I ran for president, you know, we would do rallies and we would do town meetings all across the country. And without exception, every single one of these meetings was live streamed. So we would maybe talk to 300 people in a meeting on healthcare in Des Moines, Iowa, and yet, you know, 150,000 people would be watching it on live stream. Or the rallies that we did would be live streamed. So what you had is many, many hundreds of thousands of people, suddenly we're hearing ideas that you never heard in the mainstream media. And obviously, one of the benefits of the explosion of social media is that ideas now are beginning to get out that previously were not able to.
And you really, again, you always say you don't know anything about technology, but you hire people that do, or at least associate yourself with people who do. But you went into that very early. Mm-hmm. And your Senate office had, you know, incredibly high levels of Facebook and Twitter and all this. Do you think that is a part of why you were able to break through?
No doubt it had a very important role. But the truth is, people are not going to watch what you're producing unless you have something to say.
Of course.
So what we're doing right now, I mean, not only on national stuff, in Vermont we do a thing we call the Bernie Buzz, which is our own newsletter. And we do it two or three times a week. And we talk, it's not only about political issues. We talk about, you know, recently in Vermont, a young woman from northern Vermont won the 3,000-meter world championship. We're very proud of her. Mm-hmm. And we had a, you know, a story about her. And the open rate is like phenomenal.
People actually, 25-30%. When you say an open rate, we need to explain to people that that means you send out a blast about something, you say this is available.
And usually our open rate is between 25% and 30%.
That's huge, because
that
means...
Which is off the charts.
Yeah.
Okay. So we are communicating to the people of Vermont the work that I'm doing here, the resources that are available to help them, what people in the state of Vermont are doing. And we're doing that very consciously and I think effectively.
Last thing I want to go into here on this is you, as you've become more prominent, and you are more prominent because, among other things, you ran for president of the United States. As you become more prominent, there's an awful lot of people who, you know, they'll say, boy, if we could get Bernie Sanders to come for our strike or for our organizing drive or for what we're doing, that could matter. And I know you don't like that part of it. You don't like the celebrity flying in part of it. But it is an interesting dynamic of our media that it will respond to a prominent person who shows up. And it is one of the things that you have been able to do. You maintain an incredibly active schedule to go down to Mississippi to be with auto workers there, or to go out to Michigan to be with, you know, cereal food or breakfast food makers there, and that.
Work with nurses in New Jersey.
Yeah, and it matters to
it
show
does
up.
Matter.
And I'm not talking about just you, I'm talking about political leaders and others. It matters if they go to where the struggle is.
Well, it matters for two reasons. Number one, it attracts attention, which is helpful to them. Also, I think it makes the owners, you know, the corporate guys say, uh-oh, you know, this thing is not, I can't hide this thing, what I'm doing here, and I'm trying to cut wages or cut health care. Uh-oh, it's going to be on the national thing. You know, we deal with, what do you think hearings are about mm-hmm. in the United States Senate? Why do we bring the heads of the major drug companies before us and say, tell me why you're charging Americans 10 times more for the same drug that you sell in UK or France or Mexico? They don't have good answers. They don't want that questioning. All right. Mr. Schultz, who was the CEO of Starbucks, did not want to be questioned as to why the NLRB had filed dozens and dozens of charges against Starbucks for breaking a labor law. That's not what they want. But to the degree that you can force these guys to be in a situation where they have to answer questions, we're going to do that. By the way, we're working on something right now. The UAW is, as you know, attempting to organize in the South, mm-hmm. and they may have some real huge breakthroughs. We intend to do a hearing to ask the CEOs of some of these large foreign-owned non-union companies why they are responding to Americans' efforts to form a union very differently than they do in Europe.
Which is something we talk about a lot in the book, is these comparisons of different places. And as a last question here, when that happens, when there is a Senate hearing, or when you and maybe you bring Danny Glover with you or somebody like that, when you show up for a picket line or something, that at a point where we've seen so much of a collapse of local media, that brings a local issue up to the national level.
Right.
And that, I mean, it's not the answer. It's not the solution. The solution, of course, is to find ways to renew local media and to, you know, supercharge public broadcasting to get a better media that is responsive. But in the absence of that, if you could take a local issue up to the national level, it does create that pressure.
And we do that all the time. It's exactly what we do, John.
And on that note, we've been talking a lot about media here and a little bit about how things intersect with other countries, bringing in foreign auto company executives and things like that. In the next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about ways in which you've learned from and sought to influence foreign policy and international affairs. And that's a big part of the book, so many ideas that have come from around the world. So we hope that people will stick with us and join us again for our next conversation where we finish up talking about the world.
If you'd like a copy of the book, please make a donation of $12 or more, or whatever you can afford, to my campaign, and we will get you a copy. You can do this at BernieSanders.com/book. Again, that's BernieSanders.com/book. Thank you very much.